Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco, and my guest this morning is Dr. John Apsley. Dr. John Apsley, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure getting up this early to join you guys.
Huh. So you're joining us from the state of Washington?
Yes, just outside of Seattle. But I'm originally a Connecticut Yankee, so this brings back good memories.
Oh, very good. Now, your area of expertise is cellular regeneration, is that right?
Yes, that's what I've been concentrating on for the past 30 years.
So what is cellular regeneration?
Well, there's, you know, today there's this arising, this emerging new science that is being called regenerative medicine. And most people today, when they hear that, think in terms of stem cell research. And that's, of course, a part of it. My research has concerned the longest-lived individuals that, for the most part, don't have doctors, don't have hospitals, and have exuberant health. They don't start their aging process at all until they're about 90. And so since about 1970, we have some really good data on about 30 different cultures from around the world. And part of the problem with modern science that doesn't always get recognized up front is we have to have benchmarks. We have to have reference points in order to conduct our studies from. So what that means is that if we're not using the proper reference standards to guide our research, then we're not going to hit the mark properly, and we're going to lowball what the actual human constitution is capable of and set our goals below that. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
Many years ago, there was an MD, PhD named Dr. Broda Barnes, and he conducted some amazing research that related to the human constitution. And one of the areas that, because he was an endocrinologist, that he was really concerned with was, what is proper thyroid function? What is that standard where the thyroid gland is expressing itself with exuberance, with real resilience? And after he had retired, he, while he was conducting his search and while he was implementing the solutions that he discovered, he reflected that of the 1,500 patients he had treated over his entire career, that there were only four that had heart disease. Now, we know that 1,500 people should have had about 75 of them with severe heart disease, but yet he only had four. He didn't change the diet. He didn't implement any sort of preventive medicine practices. The only thing he did was to give natural desiccated thyroid to his patients. And over the course of nearly 40 years, it prevented them from going into not only any of the known forms of heart disease, but also related to diabetes and cancer and arthritis.
Just to clarify, the natural desiccated thyroid, would that be like the Armorall?
Be like Armor, correct.
Armor.
It'd be like Armor. Armor's from porcine sources, and there are other desiccated thyroid sources from beef, from bovine. And and that contains the same kind of hormone ratios of T4 and T3. T3 is the active form that we have in our own human thyroid. So now going back to his original research to give you guys an idea about what his main concern was and what his solution that he discovered was all about. He was a young doctor, and he knew that the standard for proper thyroid function had not been determined. This goes into the 1930s, into the early part of the 1940s. And so what he did was he went into a village, a large, it was actually a tiny kingdom in Austria, and they had an inordinate number of heart attacks in the 1930s, before World War II. And there was a princess who was in charge of that kingdom, and she really cared about her people, and so she had autopsies conducted on everyone who died in her kingdom. And so when he ventured there, when it was safe to do so, prior to the war and a little bit after the war, he was able to collect some startling data of complete, thorough autopsies, and was able to see basically the future with a crystal ball of what was going to be the number one killer here in the U.S. and in most of the industrialized countries. But this is before that had happened. And what he noticed was is that these people had what looked to him to be a real serious thyroid disorder. And being an endocrinologist, he knew that Austria would have been low in iodine because it was pretty far away from the ocean. And so he began to look at what would happen if the iodine was put back into their diet, and if he could take the same signs of what he discovered from these autopsies and compare what he was seeing with his patients. And he had a really keen mind for observation. And as a result of putting iodine back into the diet of the Austrians, this little town, or this little kingdom, rather, the princess was able to reverse the disease trends there. And so when he went back and implemented this in his practice, he started using thyroid in relatively large amounts, more than most people were doing. And he wrote a paper that was published in, I believe it was either JAMA or the New England Journal of Medicine, I can't remember, in August of 1941. And he had done comparisons with these really elaborate basal metabolic chambers that you stick a patient into them for at least 6 hours, and you measure their carbon dioxide output, their oxygen intake, their body temperature, the amount of sweat that they're putting out just while they're resting in that chamber. And then he could determine, because that was the standard back then, on whether or not that the metabolism of the patient was up to standard. And he discovered that by doing a simple underarm test first thing in the morning before the patient got out of bed, that it was every bit as accurate as to put these patients into a six-hour ordeal. Mm. And that was what that paper was about. So that became known as the basal axillary test. That was his claim to fame, and it became famous throughout the endocrinological community. And so for many years, up until the late 1950s, people were using his basic protocols along with testing the reflex on the Achilles tendon, because it's slow when you don't have enough thyroid hormone. And lo and behold, there were just a lot of people that felt really, really good. Their health was very vibrant. Well, now here's my point. In the late 1950s, there was an attempt to standardize what the actual hormone levels were in the bloodstream. It was going to be this new science coming along, and we're still using the same data, basically, as back then. And so they took what they thought were healthy U.S. college kids, and they went to several campuses, and they took about 20,000 of these kids, and they assumed that they were all healthy because they didn't know about how to really look for the signs of low thyroid, like Dr. Broda Barnes had discovered from his extensive autopsy reports from Austria. They just made the assumption that these young kids had to be healthy, and it wasn't true. And so those blood levels of different hormones were used to set what all folks should be, not realizing that these blood hormone levels were inadequate. And so we've been using that since then. And then on top of that, the other real crisis, I think, that's facing us with the prevention of these different diseases is that the standard medication today for treating low thyroid is related to basically a single hormone. If you're testing the blood, it's called TSH. And TSH is sensitive to T4 when you're taking Synthroid, for example, or the equivalent, the generic equivalent of Synthroid, where it's just T4. T4 are four iodines attached to the molecule tyrosine. It's an amino acid. And the problem with that is that it's inactive in the human body. It has to be converted into T3 in order for it to work in the human body. But yet T4 will cause TSH to lower. So it gives the appearance to any physician who's just relying upon the TSH score in the blood. They think, oh, the medication is adequate, and yet the body is starving for T3. So we've really missed the boat. And if you look at what active T3 does in the body, it causes the basal axillary temperature, the temperature under the arm, when we first wake up in the morning, to approach 98.0. That's normal. That's what Broda Barnes discovered was the ideal temperature under the arm, 98.0, just a regular mercury thermometer. The digital thermometers today are $10-$12. They're not very accurate. And so even if they say they are, they're not as good as the old mercury thermometers. And the range of difference in terms of still being normal is 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit. So 98.0 plus or minus 0.02. With the blood work today that we're still using, the range of normal is within a much larger span than this 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit with the simple axillary temperature test is basically free to do. So any statistician will tell you that if you have a test that the assumption was came from a group of healthy kids, but there was no legitimate study done to determine if those kids really were healthy, i.e. doing a basal axillary temperature test, and then the span of the normal hormones in the blood, so-called normal hormones, being so wide from the high normal to the low normal, compared to this really tight number of 98.0 plus or minus 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit, the statistician will tell you, well, look, it's the tighter test that gives you just a really narrow range of normal that's got to be the more accurate test compared to, you know, having a huge difference between a high normal and a low normal. So this is unfortunately what we're using today. And as a result, we've really maimed a lot of folks by not preventing over a period of 20 to 30 to 40 years entering into a crisis with their metabolism. So why do I pick on thyroid? Thyroid is the most essential hormone of all. It drives our metabolism, and we're going to be talking about a lot of that today, about what happens when our metabolisms are really working well. And I call that state the regeneration effect. It's what we are all capable of living. We're capable of living a life where our cellular metabolism is resilient, and so our resistance to all kinds of different infections and chronic degenerative diseases is extremely high. And we're getting back to what the real reference point is for what human beings are entitled by their genes to live out, and that is a very long life that doesn't start an aging process until decades after what we are experiencing here in the United States. And then just to add to that, because it'll be kind of like a teaser for the rest of the interview, a lot of folks today just generally assume, even those in healthcare, that we have the best medical system in the world. And in many aspects of medicine today, that statement is true. We have some of the most incredible surgeons. Our ability to deal with acute crisis injuries and sickness is second to none. We're unrivaled in that way. But as far as our nation is concerned, we are really sick. We have very few people that are actually healthy in the United States. This is right out of the Centers for Disease Control data. We are way over 40th in the world in overall health. Our babies are dying at birth, before birth, at a very high rate. We rank about 19th in the world for that. If you go down the list of where we rank from country to country, there are dozens and dozens of countries that rate much higher than we do. And one of the reasons is because their population spends a lot more money for their diet concerns than we spend here in the United States. Last time I checked, the average person spends about 11 cents on the dollar to eat, whereas in these other countries that are industrialized, like Japan, that have a better health profile for their entire population, they spend closer to 20 cents on the dollar for food. So in America, the business of America is business. We are the best at that. Nothing wrong with that. I love free enterprise. But we want to eat as cheaply as possible. And so this leads us into massive calorie production with little nutrients in there, such as iodine. And we think that by throwing iodine into some bread and salt, that that's enough to make our thyroid be resilient, when indeed it's only just enough that we don't have a readily diagnosable low thyroid state, like what we call goiter, where the thyroid's swelling up and it's obvious that the thyroid's not working properly. That's all that we throw back into our food supply again. It's just that little bit of iodine so that these Americans don't wind up with huge growths in the bottom part of their neck called a goiter, which was the original definition of low thyroid. It's not. We're missing the actual proper reading of the hormone levels in the blood, and we're not taking the temperature underneath the arm. And because thyroid hormone is the most essential hormone governing our metabolism, we are a very, very sick nation. And so when you're looking at the rest of this show today, there are all kinds of tidbits like that that we're missing. But among the most important ones is the thyroid.
Dr. Epsley, before you continue, I just had a couple questions about what you said already with Dr. Broda Barnes. Was he just giving the desecrated thyroid, or did he also give iodine with that?
Yes, he made sure that the diet was rich in iodine, and he always used a very thorough exam, like these Achilles tendon reflexes and the underarm temperature test. There was no blood work back then that could determine low thyroid function. But he didn't mess with the fact the person was smoking cigarettes, unfortunately, because it wasn't recognized back in his day. He didn't worry about the diet so much because there weren't GMO foods back then. There wasn't Food Inc. foods where they place chickens and beef into these yards and feed them just massive calories with low nutriture, real nutrients. And so we've become a nation that is really distant and foreign to his day.
And I don't know if you can verify this. This is just kind of an oddball thing. I heard it going along, but black walnut hulls, I heard, are a good source of iodine for people who are inland.
Well, again, it depends on the soil. Let me give you this is a good point. Today, the USDA is not using current crunches of numbers to determine what nutrients are and are not in our food supply. It's actually scandalous. Back in the 30s, there was a Senate investigation on the fact that we had a lot of dust bowls going on. Now, we've solved that. China hasn't. China has the same issue. But the topsoil, which contains the special minerals that we need, all 80 in special ratios, non-polluted, is the basis to the food chain, including things like iodine. And we were running out in 1936. We were just running out. And by 1948, there was an excellent study that was conducted by a researcher, I believe his name was Furr, and Rutgers University published it. And he showed what the average bowl of spinach contained in 1948. He went around and went to different stores and different brands and different canned spinach and fresh spinach. And he determined that an average cup of spinach contained 152 milligrams of iron. Well, just 20 years later, when the USDA was doing its own studies in the same way, there was less than 2 milligrams of iron that was found in an average bowl of spinach in the United States, grown in the United States. Now, at that point, that became chilling, from going from 152 to less than 2 milligrams in 20 years. And the reason why was that the business of America is business. After we won World War II, we had all of the raw materials that the Germans had left over, and the victors get the spoils. And there was this huge amount of nitrogen-rich powder that was used as gunpowder and as explosives and all that. And so we were wondering back then, what could we do with all of this munitions, all of this gunpowder, all these explosives? And someone got the bright idea, oh, we can use it as fertilizer. It's free. We can just take it home with us. We won the war. And so we hauled over all of that stuff, and we spread it out on the croplands without putting the 80 trace minerals back in that we were taking out with every crop harvest. And there was basically 4 minerals in that, and that still is used today. So we've been raping and pillaging the soil since right after World War II, and in 20 years it was reflected in the USDA's Handbook Number 7. From the Rutgers study that was published in 1948 to the USDA's Handbook Number 7 that was published in the early 60s, we dropped from not only 152 milligrams of iron per average bowl of spinach to less than 2, but all of the other minerals followed suit: calcium, potassium, magnesium. And so we then were entering into a crisis in our food supply that has not been remedied yet, not even in the organic circles, although it's better. The organic circles still have not recognized this horrible food chain deficiency and have not adopted special techniques, such as adding rock dust, it's called, where there's all 80 minerals in super fine powder form, which is what's required, to be placed back onto the soils so that it enters properly into the food chain by way of getting into the gullets of the soil bacteria. That's the start of this problem and the start of the human food chain. Cultures that live in the mountainous ranges and near volcanic activity, they don't suffer from this problem, and that's why all the longest-lived cultures are found there, even to this day, such as in Sardinia and Ikra, Greece. There are exceptions like Okinawa, although most of those folks are dying off, where the minerals remain extremely rich for one reason or another, able to feed the soil bacteria. That was the secret. That was the starting point, and that included your iodine that you were asking about. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, I was wondering about the role of selenium and how that relates to iodine, because I heard there's a connection there.
Well, if you're looking at going into the minutiae, we can talk about selenium and iodine. I'd rather not, because
sure.
It's 80 different trace minerals and macro minerals. And they have a special relationship with each other. And to get to your point, there is a special relationship between iodine and selenium, especially for the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland uses a lot of iodine, just like the breast tissue does in women. And it is an oxidizing mineral. And the way to buffer that free radical-producing iodine is with selenium. So in the human body, the highest concentrations of selenium, if it's available in the diet, will wind up in the thyroid gland because there's an enzyme that requires it to quench the excessive amounts of oxidation that occurs when you're handling the mineral iodine. Now, there have been several Nobel Prize winners that have won the Nobel Prize based upon the way in which that the body oxidizes and quenches oxygen. And it's how, basically, that as life evolved, it evolved the ability to handle oxygen in more and more sophisticated ways, which became punitive for the parasites and the invaders that would normally attack that life form. So that that life form then developed an immunity to attack from the parasites, from the bacteria, from the fungus, from the viruses, because their systems were able to produce oxide-free radicals that were toxic to those lower life forms. And that's the key, that if we look at that redox potential in the body, we establish with minerals a very strong ability to oxidize, to create free radicals within the context of antioxidants that quench them for the healthy cells, and things like cancer and things like infectious diseases don't have built into them the antioxidant protections that our normal healthy cells do. And that's the fundamental reason, from a chemical point of view, why these folks live to the age of 90 in these remote areas before they even begin their aging process. They're really pumping out the oxygen-free radicals, but their diet is giving them so many antioxidants that they're able to properly deal with that without harming their own cells and genetic structure.
So how and why do the cells in our body degenerate?
So it's a perfect leading question, because we've been covering that. So basically, the reason why is because that as science stands today, particularly cell physiology has made a wrong turn with looking at what really governs cell physiology. The making of a wrong turn started way back in the last century, actually toward the very end of the 1800s. And by 1948, we had adopted a salt-based chemistry to look at cell physiology. We're not a salt-based chemistry. The biochemistry and the organic chemistry that happens inside our body is taught to medical students today and to future researchers in such a way that it looks like it's being dominated by crystalloidal chemistry or salt chemistry, and that's just not what actually happens. To answer your question, you have to look at what is the actual chemistry that governs life and what's happening to that that's causing it to break down, so that we can understand how to rebuild it and how to preserve it. And it comes down to just three things, which is nice. Due to the research of the Tesla of cell physiology, his name is Gilbert Ling. He worked with Raymond Damadian, who was the inventor and the discoverer of the first MRI unit. Raymond Damadian, MD, PhD, graduate from Harvard, had perfected the first MRI called the Phonar, spelled with an F, and he became enormously wealthy. He wasn't credited with being the discoverer of the first MRI, but he was. Someone else was given the credit for it. But he made a lot of money as a result, and so he formed his own peer-reviewed medical journal. And he hired Gilbert Ling, who was a biophysicist and a cell physiologist, and they went about looking for the first time in history at living tissue. They didn't have to stain it. They didn't have to kill it. They could use the MRI to look at single layers of cells that had been harvested from the sartorius muscle of frogs. Why? Because in the muscle of frogs, in the sartorius muscle, it's really easy, relatively easy, to get a slice of tissue that's a single layer of cells thick. Whereas most of the other people that were trying to study the what the cell physiology was really doing were harvesting from the gastrocnemius, from the main muscle of the frog. And unfortunately, that doesn't leave you with a clean layer of single cells. It leaves you with injured cells, and they're kind of clumped together in some spots. So you can't reproduce the pure studies that Raymond Damadian and his colleagues were able to do by Gilbert Ling's technique. And they made it, they published this, they kept on telling everyone, and people just wouldn't listen to them.
And what decade was this?
This started back in the 70s, and they have now accomplished over 40 years of peer review research that has proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is, for the most part, in most of the cells of the body, there is no such thing as the sodium-potassium pump. That's startling revelation. That means that because the sodium-potassium pump, which is the foundation of cell physiology today, that everyone's using to develop drugs and to find out what the pharmacokinetics of it is, how it's transported, how it's excreted, how it's metabolized, is basically wrong. That if the cell, if the sodium potassium pump, which was the half chemistry prize, Nobel Prize was awarded to, I believe his name was Chan in 1997, if that's wrong, and Gilbert Ling has proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is. In other words, he's established the real science of how cells work. It has nothing to do with the sodium-potassium pump. And yet the entire medical profession and cell physiology research continues to believe that it's there. We've really gone off into left field. So now, to come back to answer your question, what Gilbert Ling discovered with Raymond Damadian's wonderful phonar machine was that the cells operate on colloidal chemistry. They operate with a very special kind of water that's inside the cell that's highly organized, and it is polarized, just like a hard disk is. We think a hard disk that can trap zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zeros and ones. Well, the cell has done the same thing. The cell is full, the healthy cell, is full of multiple structured layers of water that toggle between themselves with slightly different charges, positive and negative, not zeros and ones like a hard disk, but positives and negatives, and it layers one layer after the other. And that layering is where information exchange takes place, where you're having epigenetic signaling, both in short distances to cause the genome, omics to play out, and the proteomics to play out, but also between cells, proper communications between cells. And that water structuring, what Gilbert Ling called polarized multi-layers of water, is there is a scaffolding to it, and it goes back to our minerals that we just talked about, that these 80 different minerals that are suspensions of minerals, not dissolved in the water, that enter into the food chain and stay that way as they go up the food chain, are suspensions of, let's take the cations that are their positive charges. They have a dynamic relationship of not truly combining into a salt-based ionic chemistry with things in the cell. They remain relatively free as positive charges. And the last puzzle, piece to the puzzle, is the unique kind of protein that the cells are composed of on the inside, kind of like Jell-O. When you make Jell-O, it's made out of gelatin, and gelatin has this unique structure. It's very high in proline peptides. And the reason why that's so and so important is that the end of these long chains of amino acids that are rich in proline, that are part of the gelatin complex, the collagen complex, are negative charge ends. And these negative charges at the ends of these proteins that are the basic scaffolding to all the cells of the human body are what attract the positive charges of these cations, these minerals that are floating through the bloodstream. And that replaces what we think of in terms of the sodium-potassium pump. It's a simple electrical charge. Now, this is the chemistry of the long living. This is the chemistry of the ones that live long, that live disease-free, or basically disease-free. It is simple electrical charges being attracted, and Gilbert Ling called that the association induction hypothesis, but it's proven now. It's no longer a hypothesis. He took on all challengers that tried to rip him apart, and he blasted them away over 40 years. He went through the proper scientific method of here, challenge me, take my data, you know, try to refute it. And he did this for 40 years, and he won every single argument. And it's there for anyone to look at in the peer review. That is beginning to dawn on the cellular biologists. They have adopted it first throughout many of the universities here in the United States. But it's going to take probably another 25 years, which is a generation, to replace this notion that crystalloidal chemistry, i.e. sodium potassium pump theory, is the governing system of what cells do. So in a nutshell, when we suckle from mother's breast milk, when she's eating from a soil that's full of minerals, we are endowed with huge amounts of proline-rich peptides with the minerals that come in through the breast milk that, to a large extent, after we've breastfed for a couple of years, we're going to keep that inside our bodies for the rest of our lives, and we're just going to recycle that material. That's number one. And number two, this water. This water is structured. And if you look at what happens when we're involved with pollution, we're involved with chemical insults, when we take pharmaceutical drugs for long time periods, when we take recreational drugs for long time periods, when we're exposed to EMFs from the smart meters that we sleep next to at night and don't know it, those elements, those factors are what chew apart and destroy the structured water within our systems. And so we have a communication breakdown that happens, and that's why we're having so much problem in the United States today and the industrialized countries with chronic degenerative disease. So that is, in a nutshell, what this new chemistry of life is all about, what Gilbert Ling's been talking about, what all of his research is, and what the longest-lived people are using to not only live to the age of 90 before they start their aging process, but to live what Claude Bernard said was the real kind of homeostasis we're endowed with. See, today we're taught that, oh, homeostasis simply means balance. No. Claude Bernard never said that. He said that the optimal state of balance in the human body is a cellular resilience that endows the person with disease-free living. And we've not paid any attention to that because the milieu, the environment of the cells, is a colloidal matrix. And we're not feeding it properly. We're not studying it properly in terms of how we develop drugs and our treatment regimens. And it's what's gotten us into so much trouble in this country.
No, we're saying that the minerals that we get from the mother's breast milk are recycled throughout our life?
Yes. If you took hamburger and you put it into a centrifuge and you put it at 20,000 cycles per minute, hamburger meat is approximately 70% water. And yet if you stuck it in a centrifuge and spun it around and you let it go, let's say you let it go all day, you would expect that at that speed that you would be able to collect quite a bit of water. And you don't. You hardly collect any. And so that's what Gilbert Ling was his main first point, trying to get the entire scientific community to look at the difference between what happens in a healthy cell, how resilient it is, how tough it is, compared to what, you know, we've been looking at with other kinds of experimentation. And what he found is that there's something really incredible that happens with water when it's associated with the right kinds of minerals that are also associated with the right kind of protein inside the cell, these proline-rich peptides. It is one tough mother. It holds on to itself despite the most harsh treatments, and it doesn't let go. And this water that forms these polarized multilayers because of modern technology like cell phones when we put them up to our ear, and the smart meters when we're sleeping right next to it on the outside of the wall of the house and we don't know it, or when we have Wi-Fi throughout the apartment or house, those are light signals, very powerful wavelength signals that can upset this water system and can break it apart. There is other factors that can rip into this water system, i.e. mercury, for example. Because what are we talking about here? We're talking about a hard disk system that has an ability to communicate with wires of water. The signaling goes through the water when the water is highly organized. When the water is disorganized, when it's chaotic and it's not in a proper structure with itself, the signaling doesn't happen. And the multi-layers of organized water, these sheets of organized water that lay on top of each other, are held in place and are structured to begin with by this proline-rich peptide scaffolding inside the cell that is having a relationship of attraction and repulsion of these minerals that we get from the diet. It's three simple things. And when that pulsation of life occurs, genomics works properly. And when that pulsation of life works, proteomics works properly. But what do? We go in and we try to find out, well, what gene isn't working right, what protein enzyme structure in the cell isn't working right, without asking the causal reason why it's not working. We don't care about Gilbert Ling's discovery. We don't care that the water inside that cell is all not properly structured. We don't care that the cell has an imbalance of minerals that are supposed to be attracting and repulsing, attracting and repulsing to the scaffolding of the protein inside the cell. We don't care that that particular patient's cell, the tissues that we're analyzing, came from a person, a human being that wasn't breastfed. We don't care about any of that stuff. We've gone down, we've taken the wrong turn in science. We're not studying the longest-lived people who have this chemistry. We're studying degenerate people, degenerate tissues, degenerate cells, and not studying them properly because we're not harvesting them properly. And we're expecting to get some sort of great science out of it. And that's the reason that since 1950, there has been no significant improvement whatsoever in our treatment for cancer. The Centers for Disease Control keeps a data bank called SEER, S-E-E-R. It's an acronym for their huge net that they put out to all 50 states to analyze what the outcome is for the treatment of cancer in this country. And the last data that was collected by a brilliant epidemiologist was updated up until 2006, showed conclusively that despite the spin of the statisticians, we have had no improvement in the treatment of cancer in this country since 1950. What we have had, due to some areas of improvement in hygiene and in prevention, such as people quitting smoking cigarettes, we have had improvement there, but it was lumped together into, well, we've made some improvements, and let's give a little bit of credit to the kinds of cancer treatments that we're giving, when it's unjustified. It didn't come from our use of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. It didn't come from that. It came from better hygiene and better prevention. Just people living with refrigerators, that was where the credit ought to go to. And also lastly, and perhaps more importantly, what's called lead time bias. We have instruments today. We have MRI today. We have certain blood tests today that are able to tell us that a patient has cancer earlier on in their disease progress. So because we're catching it early, and because we claim victory if the patient lives until 5 years and one day, we think that, oh, we have a victory here with whatever treatment we gave them, when that's a misapplication of where the credit should go. The credit really came because we have this arbitrary limit of, let's set a 5-year time period that the patient lives, and then if they live for 5 years and one day, we get to declare victory. Well, if you're diagnosing the cancer sooner, of course the patient's going to live longer, regardless of what you do or don't treat them with.
Right.
And we claim that as a victory, and how we've made improvements in our treatment of cancer. We haven't. There are some rare exceptions. There are some exceptions with skin cancer, for example, and testicular cancer. But they're real rare kinds overall of cancer. The 28 most prevalent forms of cancer have had zero improvement rate from the kinds of treatments we've given. Why? Because we're using the wrong chemistry.
Have you heard of Kerry Reams and his work with cancer?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Kerry Reams was a mathematician. He was a biophysicist. He was an agricultural expert. And he got sick, and he had friends that got sick, and he applied his ability to look at the food chain and look at what nutrients should be in the soil to what should be in the human being. And so he was able to do some interesting measurements with the blood and with the urine and with the saliva of folks as a non-medical professional. And because of the way his mind worked, he got really close to what I've been talking about with the discoveries of Gilbert and Ling. He was able to determine that there was a colloidal chemistry in the body. He had this big term that he used called ionization potential. And he had all kinds of different fancy ways that were using natural ingredients to try to reinstill the high energy state back into people again. Well, what is the high energy state? Well, we have to go back to these minerals that come off of glaciers. During the wintertime, glaciers get heavier because there's more and more snow added to them. And they crush the rock that they sit upon, and they pulverize it into this super, super fine micron kind of rock dust. And during the spring, when the melting occurs, the water melts, and it takes itself down through the mountain streams, and there are all these whirlpools that occur just through gravity. And if you look at the apex of a whirlpool, which is like an upside-down cone, the apex, as the water travels around faster and faster as it hits the apex, the acceleration approaches infinity, not the speed, but the acceleration. And what happens with water is that when it's wrapping around and spinning at that high, high speed as it approaches the apex, there's all these minerals that are suspended in the water that are coming down from this spring melt. And the bonds of the hydrogens attached to the oxygen of the water molecule, they're able to stretch a little bit. And when they stretch, they open up little spots, little positions, if you would, for them to grab onto these minerals that have an electrical charge to them, the positives or the negatives. And as a result of that, it locks this new bond angle of the hydrogens with the oxygen into position, and the water becomes more wet. And that is the first step in the food chain of what happens with water when it goes into both the soil as well as into any animal that drinks it. It's more wet. It will deliver better, in this case minerals that are coming from the glacier having pulverized the minerals. It'll take out toxins better because it's wetter after it drops off its nutrient load. But most importantly, as it enters into the soil, the bacteria are able to eat this kind of minerals that are brought to it by way of water. And these minerals are very special, and this is where it relates to your question about Kerry Reams. The minerals develop layers of other electrical charges that they're attracting to them. So let's say you start with a negative charge mineral like iodine. It will attract a positive charge mineral to it within close distance. And then that forms like a little ring. And then that ring, which on the outside now has become mostly positive, attracts a negative. And then that next layer that's mostly negative attracts another layer that's mostly positive. That's called zeta potential. That means that this nucleus of mineral that starts the whole process of growing an onion that has positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative structure to it, and then that's all in the water everywhere, where you have these little zeta potential particles that are now relating at a distance with each other, and it's the water is just full of these minerals. That means that the bacteria that are eating this have a huge amount of energy available to them that they can use any way they want. It's free. And it travels into the protoplasm of the bacteria because it's so tiny, because this water is able to deliver it into the bacteria. That is the foundation of the food chain, and that's why we're so sick. We're not replicating that in our growing methods, in our Food Inc. way of going about things, and that's what Carrie Reams, without knowing that food chain scenario that I just gave you, that's what he instinctively knew he had to give back to people to get their ionization potential up really high again. It was another way for saying he needed to get those positive and negative charges back into the cells of the human being, and he was really clever about how he did it. Unfortunately, it's difficult to duplicate his work because he was constantly fidgeting and adjusting for each individual with his different methods to get it just right. And he had a huge success rate for recovering people from near-death experiences. But for the most part, all of the people that he trained had a difficult time doing that kind because they didn't have that mind that he did.
Now, hard water, would that be considered wet water because it has a lot of minerals in it? Or not?
No, it's the colloidal state of the mineral. If it's mostly just calcium carbonate or calcium oxide or calcium phosphate, then the answer is no. It has to have these minerals that are in their zeta potential, high zeta potential state, and then it would be yes. So, and this is foreign to most people. See, most people don't know what zeta potential is. They don't understand that all the long-living cultures get this special water that's laced with minerals, but these minerals are in a high-energy state as opposed to that the minerals are simply there in the water in a low-energy state. They don't get that. So we have to rearrange our thought process about not only cell physiology, but really how the food chain actually works. Now, let me give you an example. We're now entering into regenerative medicine. We're talking about stem cell therapies and injecting stem cells into human beings to recover them from stroke and from Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease and even cancer. And so let's look at that for a moment, because that's really where that we repair. And I'll give everyone an example of what we do when we're healthy and we're age of 25. And why we should be focusing on this repair system that we're endowed with, that I call the regeneration effect, that I state is the reason why these people living in remote regions all over the world with the environmental conditions that we've been talking about, the proper ones, don't start their aging process until they're 90 years of age. What is it that's actually happening here? We have this chemistry composed, it starts with three things, where we have this very unique kind of protein that's proline-rich, that's surrounded by a whole bunch of minerals that are pumping back and forth with positive attracted to negative. And then they get too close together and they repulse backwards and then they reattract. That's governing our DNA and governing our proteomics. And at the age of, and structuring the water in there, that at the age of 25, we have 100,000 mutations or serious injuries that occur to our DNA, our gene pool, every single day in every single one of our cells. And we have about 75 trillion human cells in the average human being, maybe a little less, maybe a little bit more. But it's 75 trillion human cells. And just in the nuclear core, just where the genes are, we have 100,000 injuries that occur just because of living. And when we're healthy at the age of 25, within that 24-hour time period, we repair that. We repair that, not just in one cell, but in 75 trillion cells. Well, I ask you, why the heck aren't we studying that system? that repairs at that quantum level and fix it rather than go about the business of treating disease. You see, Hippocrates got it. Hippocrates said, don't treat the disease, treat the patient. And Claude Bernard said it. He said the germ theory is secondary. It's not the germ that's causing the disease, it's the environment. Well, if you have the reference point, like what Broda Barnes started studying when he studied the people in Austria, if you have what these longest-lived people are doing for under $1,000 annual income a year, they have no doctors. They have no hospitals. They just live with the land. And they're able to enjoy a state of resilient cellular expression that lives disease-free. And we've made it so damn complicated. That's what we need to do. And it turns out that when this water, this special water laced with this zeta potential minerals, enters into the cell of the bacteria, that the bacteria explode, reproducing itself and producing this huge amount of protein inside its own body, we call it plasma, or the protoplasm. And perhaps the greatest agricultural scientist that we've had here in this country, William Albrecht, he was at the University of Missouri, he stated that it's this protein, it's this specific protein that comes from the bacteria in the soil that has to be at 25% the content of the soil in order to maintain healthy animals, healthy husbandry. And of course, he meant also that for human beings, because we either eat the animals or harvest off the corn and the soy and eat it ourselves. And what actually is happening is that the plants, as they send out their root hairs, and this bacteria reproduce and die, they're laying down this incredible colloidal zeta-rich protein content into the soil that form the universal replacement parts that the plants can readily take up into their own root hair system and then can immediately put this high-energy state protein protoplasm to work in their own bodies. And then these plants are healthy, and they don't need insecticides, and they don't need pesticides, and they don't need herbicides. And then the animals that eat those have this high-energy state that transfers into their body. You know, it's a mystery to most people, but it makes a hell of a lot of sense. Why do 70% of our immune cells, 70%, hang on the inside of our intestinal tract? In other words, on the inside, meaning on where the bloodstream is, not on the inside, that's really the outside. That's what we consider the outside. The intestinal tract is 30 feet long, and on the inside, it's where the food goes through, and on the outside is where the food goes through, and on the inside is where the blood makes contact with the nutrients coming in. That's where most of our immune cells hang. They're waiting specifically. They've been programmed specifically to look for the same darn thing that plants do with the soil bacteria. They're looking for this high zeta potential food protein colloid that's tiny, that passes through the intestinal barrier, that they can engulf and then deliver where they need to be, where it needs to be delivered into the human body. Now, Alexis Carrel, the Nobel Prize winner in 1912 for figuring out how to sew blood vessels together, discovered that. He wrote about it. He said that these white blood cells he called nurse cells. He called them trophocytes. And he knew that they picked up these very special colloidal-rich food factors. He discovered these colloidal factors in all embryonic foods, especially starting with chickens, that they're in this colloidal state, and if you don't cook them and you don't destroy them, they will go instantly into making cells super, super healthy. And from there, we learned that there's growth factors in there, We learned that there is colloidal water in there, structured water. We learned it's full of minerals, and we learned that it was full of proline-rich peptides.
So that means eating the raw egg gives you all those things if you don't cook it?
Eating the healthy raw egg gives you all those things.
I see.
Without giving you salmonella.
Right.
Okay, that's exactly right. Embryo, egg, you made the connection. Bee pollen, it turns out that the endocrine organs stay in an embryonic state for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So if we ate healthy adult organs like liver, we would be able to get these embryonic factors into our diet. We can also get them from algae.